Ed Pohl interviews attorney Rick Simses on the subject of alternative fee billing. They discuss sharing the risk of a matter with the client, what it means, and how it should impact the client's fee.
I'm excited because our topic today is alternative fee billings, and or sometimes called pricing, and you're one of the leading folks in that arena, and your firm as well. And I'm wondering, in today's world, the preeminent method of billing is based on the hour, and yet we're talking here today about alternative fees. Has hourly billing been the way that lawyers have always billed for their services? And if not, how did we get to where we are today?
Well, I believe that when I started practicing in 1981 through probably up to about 5 years ago, it was definitely the billing format of choice by the clients and the lawyers, I believe. And I think in the last 5 years, it's changed quite a bit, going towards an alternative fee arrangement.
And there's been dissatisfaction, I've heard, and that's, I guess, why we're talking today, with the methodology by a number, as you indicate, in the last few years. The question that comes to mind, though, if we've been doing the hourly billing methodology for so long, is there anything still right with it? Or was there ever anything right with it?
Oh, I think there is. I think, you know, I think it's a matter of preference between the client and the attorney or the law firm and how they want to arrange for fees. And, you know, I think in some situations the hourly rate is just fine. It depends on what the client wants. If the client wants purely to be billed by the hour, then you do it. But I think there's other ways that if both the client and the law firm are willing to take risk and share the risk, more sharing the risk than taking a risk, I should say, I think that's been the trend.
Well, when we talk about sharing the risk, what kinds of risks can we share? Lawyers, and I remember going into law, when I went through law school, the one thing the lawyer was taught not to do is share the risk. This was something we were taught to be objective, and we didn't get into bed, so to speak, with the client. And in fact, some of the rules of professional conduct say we can't be in business with the client and so forth and so on. So where and how is it that we can share risk in this new system?
Well, one, you don't become partners in their business. But what you do is you become partners in the lawsuit. It doesn't have to just be a lawsuit. You can have alternative billing and other types of legal services. It can be transactional. It can be litigation. It can be consulting. I think that the sharing of the risk is based on the outcome. And it's based on budgeting, and it's based on early case assessment. And you take all those together, and you come out with a goal, a success goal, and you have to meet that goal. And if you don't meet the goal, then you take a risk in not meeting that goal. And if you exceed that goal, then you share the rewards of, you know, exceeding the goals. So it's not really you're sharing in the business of the client, because you're not doing that. You're just sharing in the risk and rewards of that particular litigation or transaction.
Well, you talk about a couple of things, budgeting and early case assessment and so forth. If you don't mind, can you walk us through the process that you go through when you have the conversation with counsel, you know, corporate counsel or even a private corporate client in getting to this point?
Well, I'll give you an example how we do it here for some of our clients. Early on, it could start off with a request for proposal on the piece of litigation, and then you go from there and you obtain the litigation work, and from there you have to budget it, and you can do a preliminary budget, say a set fee for a certain amount of time to do certain things, like answer, do an early case assessment. And then after that, budget the entire litigation and have different milestones in that budget that are tied to success. For instance, you do an early case assessment and you believe that you can get out on a summary judgment, but you're going to have to do certain things to get to that point in the litigation where you can successfully prepare and file your motion for summary judgment. Well, at that point, you can do a few things. You can budget the whole case, or you can just budget to that point in the litigation where the you feel it'll be appropriate after a certain amount of discovery to do a motion for summary judgment. So what you do is you budget up to that point, and then you can do a few things. You can say, okay, at that point, we believe there's X amount of percentage of chance that or probabilities that we will be successful in the motion for summary judgment. You tie your success goal to that probability, and you can also tie a success bonus to whether you stay within budget to get to that milestone. So you can do it a few different ways. You can tie it solely to success. You can tie it to success and budget. You can tie it to budget. But what you have to do is whatever you, and that's why the early case assessment is important, because you have to determine together. This is something that the lawyer doesn't just do on its own and the client doesn't do on its own. You submit your early case assessment to the client. The client and you sit down, usually over the phone, and you go through it. And you determine and agree that these are reasonable success goals and this is a reasonable budget. And then at that point, you have an agreement and you're working as a team to get to that goal, achieve that goal, and then when you do, then both parties, the client achieves its objective, getting out of the lawsuit. If we're using the motion for summary judgment example, you've done your job and you get a success bonus. So it's a win-win situation for both the client and the law firm.
Well, we're talking about success. In your example, what happens if you don't have success?
Well, and that happens. What you do is that you have to determine your success goal. One way you can do that, you can use a success bucket or a bonus bucket. And what you do is if you, let me just use the easy math, $100 an hour, you determine together with the client that you want to put, say, 15% of that $100 per hour in a success bonus bucket. So you bill them, say you got 4 hours, you bill $400, you put $100, or 15%, I guess would be $60, of that $400 in the bucket. And at the end, when you get to where you have to determine whether you have achieved success or not, if you don't achieve success, you don't get your bonus. And then you have to define success at that point too. There's different degrees of success. Suppose we go all the way through trial and you've evaluated the case for X amount of dollars would be a reasonable settlement, and you settle that case for that amount. You would get your success bonus, or you might just get your bucket back. But if you exceed the expectations and you say you settle it for 20% below what the client and you agreed to settle the case for, or that you thought was a reasonable amount to settle for, not that you would settle for, then a percentage above what's in the bonus bucket would be paid. So if you have $100 in there and you determine that if the success goal is 25% below the number that you both agree that is a reasonable settlement figure, you would get a bonus on top of what's in the bucket. And that's usually what occurs, at least in our experience, is that we've been able to achieve success for the clients based on an agreed-upon goal. And based on an agreed-upon goal, you get a bonus. And the bonus percentage is totally up to an agreement between the client and the law firm.
So there are gradients. It's not 100% or zero.
That's correct. It can be. I mean, we tend to do it that way just because there's different degrees of success, too. You know, and things change. And what you have to have, what's really important, is that you need to have a good relationship with your client. You have to be able to know when things are going really good and adjust it downward, maybe. Because it's just, you know, you get out of it, you know, on a summary judgment when you, or you get dismissed because if you're in a multi-party case, the plaintiff, if you're a defense, decides he doesn't want to go after you. Well, you shouldn't achieve, you know, if it's early on in the case, you shouldn't get what you would get at the end of the case for the same result. So, you know, you can back off that way. But also, if all of a sudden you're up against an opponent that decides he wants to take 35 depositions, and when you thought, you know, what would have been reasonable in this case was 10, the client's going to have to work with you to adjust the budget upward as opposed to downward on the other situation, and the success goals may change as well. You know, and things change in cases, too, so it's got to be a flexible arrangement or it won't work. And we've been real lucky. We have great clients that are flexible, and you have to have sophistication on both sides. I think you have to have a lawyer and a law firm that can evaluate cases and or transactions and do it, you know, consistently and not change every time something goes wrong. But if something is a major twist or turn in the litigation, you have to have a sophisticated client who can realize, he or she can realize that, you know, there has been a twist or a turn in the case. It had nothing to do with the company or the lawyers representing the company. It's just that happens in litigation, newly discovered document, fact, or whatever, witness. And so if you can, if both parties are flexible and have a good relationship, it tends to work very well.
Well, obviously, what you're talking about now is a level of sophistication and a level, at least in my experience, both when I went through law school and my observation in today's world, that lawyers are not taught in law school. Where do we get this education? How do we become so sophisticated in, not in the law, but in this area of creating early case assessments, budgets, and relationships with the client?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I've been out of school for a while, so I'm not sure exactly what they're teaching in law school today, but they didn't teach what you're talking about when I was in law school. I graduated in 1981, so it's been a while. And, well, I think, you know, if they're not teaching things like evaluations and even classes on, you know, proper ways to consult and things like that, which we didn't get when I went to law school, you know, I guess things change. We weren't doing alternative fee billings and things like that back in the early 80s. I mean, this is something that's kind of evolved during my practice. But I'm not sure you teach that as, you know, that skill as much as you acquire it through experience. You know, it's one of those things, you know a good lawyer when you see him, well, but he has to become a good lawyer. So I think there's courses that could be taught. I think maybe there should be more continuing legal education on these topics where, you know, there's got to be more ways to do this than I know of, you know, and probably some pretty good ways. And I think, you know, kind of getting all the different, and I think there's literature out there, and there's probably an abundance of it regarding, you know, here are the different types of alternative fee arrangements, here are the ways they work, and here are the down or the, you know, pitfalls of these particular methodologies, and kind of learn how to do it. We've been lucky. We've had clients that have been innovative on their side and have wanted to change from being billed by the hour, and we were willing to change. And so we've kind of worked these things out. They didn't just, you know, they didn't pop out of the air. We've kind of evolved these different methodologies. But, you know, I think there's room for probably a course in law school for this. I don't know what you'd call it, but, you know, there's definitely room for that. And I think, if I remember law school correctly, there's room for a lot of different things in law school that we didn't get. And a lot of the practical side of practicing law, you learn the day you walk out of law school. So I think this would be a good part of a course, at least, to give students today.
You're certainly preaching to the choir. I mean, they don't even require in most law schools today courses on law practice management, let alone on the more sophisticated issues of billing clients in methodologies other than by the hour.
Oh, I certainly didn't have any of those courses, and I think, yeah, we may be on the same page in that regard. I think law schools in general probably need to look at those types of things because those are the realities when you get out. You know, how to manage your law practice, how to do it properly, how to make sure that, you know, you don't learn, you know, client services and things like that in law school. And, you know, to do it right, it may be a good idea to have a course or two like that.
You talk about various methods, and I think I started our conversation by describing it as alternative fee billing methods. Can you describe some of the different approaches you take, assuming that you're taking more than one approach to your alternative to the hourly billing?
Well, for the most part, I've kind of described how we do it. We do it with a success bonus. You know, there are situations I imagine that you can do it on a straight contingency fee if it's a I guess if you're on the plaintiff side, we don't do a heck of a lot of plaintiff work, so we don't get into contingency fees very often at all. And even when we are representing a company, one of our clients, and we happen to be the plaintiff, we typically don't do it on a contingency fee. I find that our clients and are not all that interested in contingency fees, I'm not sure why. We just have never really discussed it in depth, you know, why they're not in favor of it. And, you know, quite frankly, we're satisfied with the alternative billing methods that we use, which is primarily the success bonus way to do it, because it drives both client and attorney to just get together and, you know, really strive for the best result you can get. And it keeps both parties involved. I mean, it keeps the client involved. They're attuned to it. And if you put the whole package together with the early case assessments, you know, continuing to update it, you know, that's how we've been doing it.
One of the things you talked about earlier was the initial approach, which was an RFP. Now, if you need this kind of close collaboration with the client, and if you build what we're talking about on a stage, in other words, before you can lay out the budget for the entire litigation or the entire transaction, you've got to take it to the first stage and so forth. How do you get the representation if all you can do is a proposal for the initial stage? Or am I reading something into your RFP? Is it not an RFP to the world to get the lowest bid, but rather an RFP from an existing client to just get an idea where you want to take this for a particular matter?
Well, I can tell you what we typically receive and how we respond. Certain clients are multinational, or, you know, and have certain cases that come in, and they have certain firms that they use on a regular basis. And we luckily have been lucky enough to, I guess, to be one of those firms for several of our clients. And sometimes if there is a case that's a little different than the norm, they'll send an RFP to a couple different firms for a couple different reasons. One, and it's not always competitively, you know, for pricing. It's for, you're looking for the right expertise. Do you have the right assets in your firm to handle this particular kind of case? And that, I guess that's what I'm referring to. Typically, we don't get RFPs. But we do, more often than not now, on kind of different cases that, you know, aren't cookie-cutter cases, and they're not, all cases are different, but some are much more different than others. And so we get RFPs for that, and they're looking for whether we have the expertise, whether we have the assets, meaning do we have the teams to put together to handle the case, because they're usually large litigations. And then, you know, are we willing to do an alternative fee, and if we are, what that alternative fee is. And then, you know, several other questions go on with the RFP, whether the case is removable and things like that. Or if it's on the commercial plaintiff side, whether, you know, where would you think the best venue is and things like that. So that's what's made up in the RFP, and one of the part of that is, you know, sometimes is, you know, what will you charge to do the early case assessment, and more on a flat fee, and then going forward on an alternative fee basis after that. So that's kind of the RFPs we get, and so we respond to them accordingly.
Well, one of the things that is implicit in my understanding, at least, of what you're saying, is that your work is directly with corporate America in most of these instances. And the accusation, or the statement, it may be a better phraseology, has been made that what we're talking about has really been driven by insurance carriers. And I don't sense that in your comments. This is not an insurance-based movement, is it?
Well, my personal experience, I can't speak for other firms, but I find it just to be the opposite. I find that this is driven by both willing law firms and, just as important, innovative in-house counsel from the GC, the general counsel, down. I think they're the ones that are looking at it. Where, you know, I don't think anybody's out to, you know, this isn't a, the alternative billing isn't having, isn't solely fee driven. I think it's result driven. I think it's, you know, people in corporate legal departments and law firms are just looking for a new way to do it, a new and better way to do it. And, but I don't find it being driven by insurance companies. We do some insurance defense, and we're glad we do, but they don't appear to be as interested, I should say, in going into the alternative fee arena. But and that, hopefully that'll change.
One of the elements that underlies my understanding, at least, of where we're going with this is the need for the lawyer to give up the concept of being perfect, something we learned in law school, I think, and that is that you have to take every deposition possible to make sure that there's not some significant piece of evidence that is lying underneath somebody's cranium. And yet this is one of the things that drives prices up incredibly high. You talked earlier about the element of risk sharing. How is it that risk is shared in this context where the lawyer says to the client, you know, if we've got to take all these different depositions. We've got to do this motion and that motion and so forth. You talked earlier about the motion for summary judgment and, you know, making the decision to do that motion. How is the notion of being perfect come into play here?
Well, I think it's kind of case by case, but I think I can explain it pretty well. I think that, again, you need the relationship between the client and the law firm. You need, that's where the early case assessment comes in. And I think today, at least the way we've practiced law, you've got to determine early on, and it kind of evolves throughout the case, and who you really need to depose, and what discovery you need to do, and what discovery you're willing not to do, at least at the given moment when you make your assessment. And what I mean is, if you've got six witnesses out there, but you think four of them definitely need to depose, and two of them are marginal, well, you may not take the two witnesses you think are marginal, and you with the agreement of your client, because one, the cost, but two, you know, where's the added value to the case? Are we taking it because they might have something to say? Well, if you take a good deposition of the four other ones and you're confident that they're not going to add anything to it, why take it? I think in the olden days, you know, people would just take those depositions because they were concerned that they might miss one thing. Clients are willing to take that chance, I think, sometimes, and in the overall scheme of things, you know, and based on history, those two depositions probably aren't necessary. You know, and that's not the case in every litigation, but we have taken that approach, and we're seeing the same results. So I think there is room for the change in the way we do discovery as well. I don't think it's, you know, take no prisoners. I think it's, you know, do it reasonably, do it concisely, and know what you're looking for. I think that's important, too. And I think that has to do a lot with, you know, working with the client. If you have a sophisticated client that's involved in the litigation and is willing to help you, do your discovery, you know, get the people to interview and things like that, that goes a long ways. And it's a lot less costly for them if they participate in it.
Well, that is well and good during the process. At the end of the day, however, if that one of the two depositions would have led to the discovery of something that turns out to be important, who's at the end of the line, so to speak? The lawyer is there exposed with his malpractice insurance policy. What's to protect the lawyer? What's to say that the client will not then pursue a claim against the lawyer?
Well, that's a good question, Ed. But, you know, I think that boils down to whether you have a good relationship with your client or not, and whether you communicate. You've got to communicate these things to your client. If you decide that there's six depositions that could be taken for or, you know, crucial to the case and two are marginal, you discuss that, and then you make an agreement. We're not going to take those depositions if you agree to it. And, you know, here's the downside if we don't, and here's the upside if we do, or vice versa. Here's the downside if we don't. Maybe have that backwards. here's the upside if we do, and here's the downside if we don't. And vice versa, because there's ups and downs for both. And I think with a sophisticated client, they're going to understand that, you know, I may not have to take Ed's deposition. But let's see. Right now, we're not going to plan on taking it, and let's see how it goes. And, you know, a lot of times you never take Ed's deposition. And I think that we're finding out that we can get along in litigation with less discovery.
One of the things that lawyers are taught to do, I think, with the emphasis and the catalyst of the insurance carriers, is to document every conversation, every factor, practically, in a case so that your file is complete in case a claim is made. Is this a methodology for the lawyer involved in this kind of alternative fee billing practice to make sure that the file reflects the client's participation and the client's agreement to not take those two depositions just in case a claim is made down the road?
Well,
or is there some other way of doing it?
Well, I think documenting things like that is probably a good idea for both sides, just because we have a lot going on in our businesses and our lives. And so with the advent of email, things like that are very easy to do. I don't think that's what, you know, you call CYA. I think it's just, here's our plan and here's our continuing plan, and so that if my client wants to go back to the file, you know, 2 months later and see, you know, where we are, have we taken these four depositions, and then he sees, oh, we decided not to take these two, and, you know, that way he can call up and say, you know, Rick, do you still think we don't have to take these two depositions, and we discuss it. So to answer your question, I think it's a good idea to confirm those kind of things in writing, just so both sides have a file that reflects the agreement and also something that memorializes the path forward. And so I think that's important, but I don't look at it as, you know, every time I get off the phone with the client, do I send an email confirming it? No, I don't do that. But on the important matters, I think it's important for other reasons other than to just cover yourself.
Well, Rick, there's a whole bunch of other questions that come to mind, but I think that your answer probably would be reflected in the concept that it requires great communication between the attorney and the client, and it requires a great relationship between the attorney and the client. So, to me, it all boils down to one question, and that is, how do you get such a relationship? How do you find those clients who are sophisticated? How do you continue a relationship that's open and candid and collaborative, especially in this world of competition where you've got 20, if not more, law firms wanting the business from that particular client?
Well, the easy answer would be that we're good and we're lucky. and good first and lucky second. But I don't know. I've been lucky, too. I've been with the same law firm forever. And so we've grown together, and we have some really talented lawyers in our firm that have gotten good results. I think you don't walk out of law school developing these relationships, because you have to have the goods to and the service and the talent to provide to clients to have them trust you doing your work. And then the other part is relationships, developing them just through working together and, you know, kind of, I guess the way we've done it, it's just these relationships have just evolved from, you know, representing these clients for quite a few years and changing together. I mean, I don't know if we have any clients today that we didn't have when we were just, you know, billing by the hour. And so they've changed, we've changed. Some of the suggestions have come from that end, and, you know, other times it comes from our end. But as far as how do you develop these relationships, I think it's just, you know, you enter into them and they evolve. But you consciously evolve these relationships today, because if you're going to do these alternative fee arrangements, you have to know up front that, you know, it takes a degree of trust to do it. So, you're talking trust as you develop your relationship, because it has to be based on that.
Well, Rick, I guess one final question would be, what is it that you see as the future of the profession, future of alternative billing systems from today forward?
Well, I see it getting more prevalent. I think more and more clients, and I can't speak for other law firms, but I know our firm is always interested in trying alternative fee arrangements that work for both the client and the firm. But I think it's the way to go. I really do, but I'm not sure it's rapidly going forward. It seems to be kind of creeping along, but I think a lot of things kind of creep along until all of a sudden, the industry, the legal industry, both clients and law firms, see that, this is really something that works. So I see a good future for it, but I'm not sure when it's going to be here.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.